Well, good morning. Trust you all have had a good week and are ready for a hot one. Sounds like there's one coming. I think Rachel and I'll go to Louisiana and get away from the heat. It's actually supposed to be cooler down there this week than it is here. But anyway, quite a change, I guess, for the Fergusons. It was quite a bit cooler in England, wasn't it? From the pictures, it looked like at least you were wearing coats.
I couldn't believe I could go outside today with no coat.
Yeah.
Well, it is June.
Yes, well into it, isn't it?
Yeah. Tell you what, last Sunday we needed a coat and more than we had.
Really?
Yeah. And we had outdoor service.
So. Okay.
Okay.
Very well. Well, we are working our way through Isaiah here. And Isaiah 32 started out on a bright note, and something I think we've probably seen and come to recognize in Isaiah here is the transitions that he frequently makes between the impending peril and danger and judgment that will fall and the future bliss when the Lord redeems Israel and, in fact, the whole world. So he continues to make those transitions. In first part of chapter 32, we have the king reigning in righteousness, and we have the eyes of them that see shall not be dim. The ears that hear shall listen. And then we got down here and read a little bit about the good liberals. At least that's the way that word is translated in the King James, referring to those that are generous or noble. And he laments the fact that sometimes those that are not generous and noble are called liberal. And I guess that's what we should do, isn't it? It's become a sort of a negative word for those of us that have tried to maintain fidelity with the truth of the past. But in fact, it should be a good word. Certainly the King James translators thought so. And so then that brings us down to, we left off about verse 9 or so of last week, and Isaiah addresses the women. And so, welcome to service, ladies. And he seems to have seen things transpiring during his day, which spurred him to action. An ease, shall we say, a laziness, a lack of concern that he saw evidenced in the women of his day that caused him to burst forth with proclamations about, once again, the negative things that would happen in the imminent future for the Israelites. So he says, "Arise up, ye women that are at ease, hear my voice, ye careless daughters. Give ear unto my speech. Many days and years shall ye be troubled, ye careless women. For the vintage shall fail, the gathering shall not come." Okay, so once again, we have the agricultural metaphors that communicate trouble, disaster, when the crops fail. In a world that depends on crops, then you've got problems. You've got famine. You've got unrest. Not only that, he then proceeds to speak of the typical end of women who are part of a conquered nation, who are captured after a battle, He says, "Tremble, ye women that are at ease, and be troubled, ye careless ones. Strip you and make you bare. Gird sackcloth upon your loins." And then the next verse in King James is apparently a misunderstanding of an idiom. And if we look at some of the translations, they go like this: beat your breasts for the pleasant field, for the fruitful vine. So it's a sign of lamenting your horrible fate. We see this in various places in the Bible, this particular expression. And then verse 13, "Upon the land of my people shall come up thorns and briars, yea, upon all the houses of joy in the joyous city, because the palaces shall be forsaken. The multitude of the city shall be left. The forts and towers shall be for dens forever, a joy of wild donkeys, a pasture of flocks." And as I drive across the country from time to time, I notice there are some properties that show signs of great care. They're well kept up. The weeds are cut down. The grass is mowed. All the different little details have been taken care of. But one of the quickest ways to recognize a property where nobody's at home, nobody is living, is when you've got a ragweed growing out of the driveway cracks or something like that, right? So, and it doesn't take all that long, surprisingly, if you aren't vigilant, even if you are living there. There's no telling what's growing out some places in our driveway. My wife reminds me occasionally we need to mow the drive. need to get it sprayed. But anyway, that particular picture here, once again, Isaiah uses to speak of the coming desolation. Depeopleization comes to mind. I'm not sure that's a word, but that's all I can think of. When people are no longer a part of the city, then the wild takes over, moves in. So we have that little section in there where Isaiah reminds his readers that this coming bliss, this coming blessing of God, will be preceded by desolation. But then he makes a transition back again in verse 15. "Until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest." Okay, so this particular sequence we've seen before in Isaiah. Chapter 29, I believe, he uses a similar sequence of words. In verse 17 of chapter 29, he says, "Is it not yet just a little while before Lebanon will be turned into a fertile field, and the fertile field will be considered as a forest?" Okay, so as opposed to a landscape which is denuded of vegetation. And, of course, that was one of the results of these invasions of these foreign powers. They couldn't carry all their supplies for sieges across the thousands of miles. And so when they got to where they were going to besiege a city, they just started helping themselves to anything that was available. And usually the trees were all cut down to be used as engines of war in one way or another. And so the picture of the forest is a picture of peace times, not the picture of invasion. And so he says here, "Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field." So, one thing that I have witnessed over the years concerning wilderness, you know, I occasionally am involved in the activity of cutting, harvesting trees, and one of the things that happens when you harvest trees is it leaves sometimes large patches in the woods that spring up with anything that happens to have a seed in the ground. And it's usually things like briars and all sorts of vines and growth. And it really does become a wilderness for a while. Some people that are trying to cultivate a property for deer hunting actually want the timber cut because it becomes a great habitat for deer to hide in. And it doesn't in any way make it less desirable. And so, admittedly, for a few years after timber has been heavily cut, the property is pretty much a wilderness. And it has a different character. You may not want to walk through it without several layers of clothes on. But I was at a friend's house for a short period yesterday where he had recently built a house on a property that the timber had been cut. And it was just remarkable to me how much it had been transformed. There was a lawn. There was obvious care taken of the property. And so the contrast to the wilderness, the place where there's lots of, in some cases, the kind of wilderness I'm thinking of now, there's lots of life, but it's just totally out of control. It's growing like crazy. It's going every which direction. Of course, we know that many times in the Middle East, the wilderness referred to is a barren one. It's one that is deserted of life for the most part. But since he's talking here about areas that can grow crops and can be forested and even populated by thorns and briars, I'm thinking more of that kind of of wilderness. But as opposed to this totally uncontrolled, out of hand spread of everything, he says, then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness and righteousness remain in the fruited field. And the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness, and assurance forever. I'm liking the sound of that. I feel blessed in many ways to have been born into the period of time that I was born into, and certainly, in large measure, many of us can live most of our life and not know the kind of upheaval that Isaiah forecasts here for the land of Israel. But even in our time and in our world, we know the psychological upheaval that results from the dominance of ideas that don't give God his due place in society. And so while physically we may not be subjected to the potential of being taken captive, enslaved by a foreign country, there are constant attacks on our mind. There are constant attempts to enslave us in a free country. And so we do experience the stress of those onslaughts. And so peace still is very appealing. And you sometimes really want to say to some people, peace, be still, right? And lean on the be still part. That will bring peace. But Isaiah proclaims here that the effect of righteousness is a quietness, an assurance, a peace. And my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. And that I can definitely relate to. It's quite an experience to have your resting place invaded by the noise of your neighbors. I can't imagine life in the city with 6 or 8 inches of some sort of building material between me and many inhabitants. I don't know how people do that, because I don't think those walls are always soundproof. At least if they're built anything like some of the motels I've been in, they're not. And to come home to that every night would be, not a great proposition. Unfortunately, we sometimes experience that even when we live in places that we think are fairly out of the way and lonely. I haven't heard it yet this year, but for several years, even where I live back there on the creek, there was apparently some fine resident to the north and west that thought, since they were out in the country, they could just crank the woofers and the music as loud as they could get it. Well, sound carries. And there were times when I would lay there at night in my bed with my window shut, and I could hear the drum. I could hear the bass, and it was at least half a mile away. This quiet resting place, it appeals to me, right? I can identify with that, to truly have peace. Now notice that in verse 15, this whole section is introduced, until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high. Of course, that particular anticipation is echoed in other prophets and other places in Isaiah as well. Probably we're all familiar with the passage from Joel that Peter quotes on the day of Pentecost. In Joel 2:28, it says, "And it will come about after this that I will pour out my Spirit on all mankind. And your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old men will dream dreams. Your young men will see visions." Isaiah 44:3, Isaiah says, "I will pour out water on the thirsty land and streams on the dry ground. I will pour out my Spirit on your offspring and my blessing on your descendants." We've already read in Isaiah 11 how that Isaiah prophesies of the Messiah, that the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Now probably most of you know that this particular topic has been one of great interest to me, because I felt like I didn't fully grasp the mindset that is expressed by the prophets, and even the reality expressed in the New Testament. Some people have an incredibly cavalier attitude about the outpouring of the Spirit. It's kind of like, if you've believed in Jesus, then you have the Spirit. And some preachers just feel informed feel inclined to inform you of that and move right along. This is, you got it, right? Because that's what the Bible says. Well, it seems to be a much more consequential thing in the minds of both the prophets and the New Testament writers. To have the presence of the Spirit of God in your life is not just a unilateral action that God does in spite of all your attempts to do anything else. It speaks of an element which should transform your life. To receive His Spirit, certainly in this passage, there's a transformation involved. The wilderness becomes a fruitful field. The field is counted as a forest. Judgment dwells in the wilderness. And so while sometimes it is communicated in unilateral language, that is to say, when you say that the Spirit is poured out, that doesn't show any action on anybody else's part, right? That particular language. But in so many people's lives, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of the Spirit of God. In fact, in spite of the fact they claim to be believers, the Spirit of God does transform our lives. And when you understand especially how Paul uses the language of Spirit, you begin to realize that he identifies it with the core nature of Jesus. This, in fact, he often uses the expression "the Spirit of Jesus" interchangeably, and so then we begin to think about what it means for somebody to have a spirit, and we recognize that this is a method of communicating that there is another dimension to our existence beyond our physical body. There is the reality that emanates from us and is detectable. You can't draw a picture of it. But once you have encountered somebody with a particularly obnoxious spirit, you don't forget it. You recognize those things. So the prophets envisioned a transformation to the world that occurred whenever God's life-giving breath, His force of life, was poured out in some renewed way. We know that in the beginning He breathed life into Adam. He spoke life into existence in the animal and plant world. But there is some additional sense in which He pours out His Spirit on man who needs redemption, man who needs transformation, a creation that needs changed. And so I don't claim to have fully wrapped my brain around all the language used, but I'm watching. And that's one of the reasons that I'm particularly interested in Isaiah, is to study how he uses this concept. So we see it here, and then the last two verses of this chapter are a bit puzzling. Just read in the King James, certainly. And by the way, about the King James, I really think it's good to read there first, because there's going to be things in a translation of a book like Isaiah that are going to make you say, "What?" and that becomes the foundation for interest in studying. If you're trying to understand things, then you say, okay, I need another translation here. What's going on here? Or I need some more resources. And you might not do that if you just had something that was that made sense to you. Because, you know, you can do a translation which makes sense, but it doesn't faithfully preserve certain aspects of the original. And so here we have in verse 19, when it shall hail, coming down on the forest, and the city shall be low in a low place. Okay, now that doesn't seem to follow verse 18, right? Verse 18 says, and my people shall dwell in a peaceful habitation and in sure dwellings and in quiet resting places. When it shall hail? I'm not following there, okay? Coming down on the forest and the city shall be in a low place. Then back to a positive, blessed are you that sow beside all waters, that send forth thither the feet of the ox and the donkey. So what's going on in verse 19? Well, the simplest first step, of course, is to look at some other translations, which for some reason weren't keyed to this verse. Let's scroll up here. And in the ESV it says, and it will hail when the forest falls down, and the city will be utterly laid low. Okay, so that seems to be understood by the translators as a reflection back on the negative picture we were looking at. So sort of a flashback to that. Now, the Septuagint is interesting here. It seems that these translators were struggling with this Hebrew as well. And they say, and if the hail should come down, it shall not come upon you. And they that dwell in the forest shall be in confidence as those in the plain country. So it sees it as a continuation of all the positive things being said. However, everybody that's translating from the Hebrew doesn't really take that direction. Complete Jewish Bible, once again, I think, gives an interesting, different angle. Here it is, just as the forest will surely come down, the city will surely be laid low. Okay, so there's no hail in that verse, that translation, and I don't know why that is. But that verse too seems to, or that translation seems to understand the verse as a connection back to the negative picture that we've seen already. But at least Isaiah ends, unquestionably, on a blessed. Blessed are ye that sow beside all waters. And as we've noted many times before, the multiplicity of agricultural metaphors are sometimes hard for us to relate to, but were very much poignant messages to the audience he was writing to. Water is absolutely essential for growth, for farming, and for pasture. And so verse 20 then reflects on the blessedness of having abundance in water, both for sowing and for pasture. Okay, so Isaiah continues to prophesy that there are troubled times coming. But there is also a time when God will redeem the world and bring peace and rest to those who trust in Him. Any comments on that chapter that you'd like to make? Okay, We have another one waiting for us. Chapter 33. And this is the home of woe number 6. So 6 of 6. He says, "Woe unto thee that spoilest, and thou wast not spoiled, and dealest treacherously," that is, betrays, "and thou dealt not, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled, and when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they will deal treacherously with thee." This seems to be directed in that same period that we've been looking at of history to the Assyrians, who were going about spoiling all their enemies. And of course, to spoil is not like sour cream or sour milk or things like that. It's whenever people come and take all your stuff. So it's like these smash and grab episodes we see. They are spoiling the businesses, and of course in the time of Isaiah, the time the word was most often used in association with warfare, and the spoils of war were one of the things that made it worthwhile. Why would you go to all this effort to march across halfway across the world and all the hardships and dangers of war? Because, you know, after all, when you go to war, there's no guarantee that you're going to come home. You're taking a risk whenever you decide to approach somebody else and say, "Give me your stuff or I'll kill you," because they might just give you something you didn't want. But on the other hand, they do have stuff that you do want. And the process of taking their goods was the motivation for attacking them.
You know, it's hard to make your own clothes when it's easier to go fight to get
Indeed. Indeed it is. And then, of course, the dealing treacherously. You remember we read recently about how that Hezekiah, when he realized that the Assyrians were on his doorstep, decided he didn't feel as rebellious as he did earlier, and offered to pay them whatever they wanted, and in fact did pay them what they wanted, a huge sum. And then they came anyway, right? So what a dirty deal. Whenever you strip the temple and all the royal furnishings of their gold and silver in order to pay your debt, then the Assyrians say, "Oh, thanks," and come anyway to destroy you. That is a very treacherous deal. They're not people that you want to have a relationship with. So that's who the woe is directed against here. He says in verse 2, "O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble." Okay, so if you're reading through this, you know, we don't want to overdo pronouns, but on the other hand, this is a bit confusing here, right? So we go from, "We have waited for thee, be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble." You're like, okay, so what's the antecedent for that? Why are we talking about them all of a sudden? And so it's interesting to note that the translators have a decision here to make as well. Apparently that is a faithful rendition of the Hebrew. And in the ESV, notice what they do. O Lord, be gracious to us. We wait for you. Be our arm every morning, our salvation in the time of trouble. Well, that reads much more nicely in English, right? It just tends to flow. Notice here what Alec Moyer says about this. He says the strength slash their arm is the organ of strong personal action, strength for life. There may be here a snatch of liturgical form, with the leader saying, "Be their arm," and the congregation replying, "Be our salvation indeed." In any case, instead of a prosaic statement that in such a time of crisis, the believing church resorts to prayer, Isaiah inserts a telling cameo of prayer taking place. The alteration to our arm is the worst sort of pedantic tampering. So he feels like the making it sound good in English is not a welcome activity necessarily, because it hides something going on in the text that may be of interest. So I like that, the worst sort of pedantic tampering.
Maybe if they could just do one line bold and then one line light. Yeah.
Nice. We'd recognize that, that liturgical form. Huh? And of course, we don't know for sure that they had that particular sequence. Perhaps that's what's going on there.
So we really don't know much about what happened in the synagogues in that regard.
Well, there weren't synagogues yet. The synagogues didn't start showing up until just before the time of Christ. So houses of prayer, a synagogue, we had the temple, and we had numerous attempts through this period to centralize all worship at the temple, because Yahweh was also sometimes worshipped in other places, as well, other gods as well. But so there is a strong move to centralize all worship of Yahweh in Jerusalem at the temple.
Could you go back to the LXE, the Septuagint?
Of which verse?
Of that verse.
Was it 32?
I'm sorry, their arm.
Okay. Number two, there we are.
So it's just not in sync right there, is that right?
It is, because, see, have mercy on us, that's the be gracious.
Okay.
We have waited, we have trusted. But then, yeah, it seems to go somewhere else. So, you know, does that mean that the translators had a slightly different Hebrew version than we have now? We don't know for sure. But we occasionally encounter things like that with the Septuagint, where it's like, where did they get that exactly? But, you know, our version of the Hebrew is from, of course, that all changed in 48, whenever they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of which date back to approximately Septuagint times, 2nd century B.C. And so it wouldn't have been too far, but that doesn't mean that there weren't copies that varied.
At times I'll notice that very thing with the CJB. Like they're not in sync.
Oh, there are sometimes numbering differences.
Okay.
That is, but here there's, you know, you can notice there's enough correlation to see that.
Now it's interesting because it does go to the rebellious for that line. so it goes, it's not all towards this people group, it switches and then switches back. So it, almost like the arm is against them every morning.
Uh-huh.
There are, yeah, I don't know, it's just...
Yeah, you don't expect it, do you, to see that? Anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so Lord, be gracious to us. Be merciful. We have waited for thee. Be our salvation also in the time of trouble. At the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. Okay, and that should be if you've seen any clips of some of the video clips of some of the crowd reactions to shootings that are constantly offered up these days, you can see that image, right? At the sound of gunshots, people just start disappearing. They just scatter. They run. And so here, the noise of tumult, right? It's the analogous noise to our gunfire. People are getting out of there. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. As the running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. Okay. I think probably one of the strong elements there is the inescapability of God's conquering and spoiling things. And that God doesn't spoil things, if you know what I mean. But it's the picture of him in a position that the evil conquerors have been in, that of taking the goods of the evil. And anyway, so it's the picture. I don't know if you've ever seen any pictures of the locusts infesting crops and fields and trees. I mean, they just eat everything. They eat it down to the ground. And they come in clouds. It's a frightful thing. And so that's the image that Isaiah is drawing on here. The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. And wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times, and strength of salvation. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. Now, we have many times, I know, encountered this expression. It's throughout the Bible. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is highly elevated, that expression. And we often spend much of our time trying to dispel any connection between the expression and that we should be afraid of God. But there is something very centrally being communicated here that we need to wrap our brain around. Notice that here in this particular text, it says the fear of the Lord is his treasure. Not gold, not silver, not any other kind of possession, but the fear of the Lord. Well, the good news about that is that's accessible to anybody. It's not that easy to accumulate treasure of a metallic form. It costs you a lot. But the fear of the Lord is accessible to the poor as well as the mighty. And what I think you need to ask yourself, what is the difference in a human being? What is the difference in their mindset between one who Isaiah would say possesses the fear of the Lord and one who doesn't. What?
Spirit, as you were talking earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to think differently.
They are. Any insight into why that expression communicates it? What is there? Is there some connection between fear and the way that it causes you to behave and react, and the right kind of relationship to God? At least it reflects a vulnerability, right?
Yeah, you're fearful of things that are greater than you, or have more control than you, or more power than you, and could so you would submit to a force that has more that you fear.
Okay, but you may run too.
Right.
Try to resist.
So, what does fear do to you in life?
It holds your attention.
It holds your attention, okay. How does it interact with your will? It can keep you totally from doing things that you really would like to do, right? I would like to get in this car, but there's a snake on the floorboard, right? And so, no thank you. Not going there. It has the ability, it has the function of elevating several different ways to say this, but it raises to the top of your list of importance whatever it is that you fear. When you fear something, as you interact with what you're thinking about in life, you know. Have you ever talked to somebody and you realize they're looking over your shoulder, and they're somewhere else? You know, they're not focused. And I mean, I've done that. Sorry if it was with you, but if there's a monster behind you, though, I'm going to look at that probably and be thinking about that. And so, when you think about in life how distracted we can get, how involved we can get in different things, different activities. For most people, God doesn't become important anymore. It's like, okay, I'm not in Sunday school, it's not church time, so God's not here. It's like he's gone. He no longer exists. Well, the fear of the Lord keeps that from happening. He has your attention all the time, because in your mind, what he thinks is what really matters.
And you have to keep him in the forefront of your mind, or it can kind of dissipate. From my experience, I have to think about it, read his word, and remind myself that he's there, since I can't see him.
And so what you're doing by disciplining your mind that way is you are creating in your own life the reality of what would be communicated here as the fear of the Lord. It's not like you're saying, I'm going to be scared of God. I'm going to think about all the terrible things he could do to me. But you're creating a reality that elevates him to the position of most important above all things in your life. And many of the scriptural writers communicate that action as the fear of the Lord. Sometimes we soften it with the expression, the respect of God, but there are certainly different ways in which the literal expression mm-hmm. communicates dimensions that you need to discipline in your life. He must be the most important thing in my mind, and I need to cultivate that as though he were my ultimate fear.
I notice salvation, wisdom, and knowledge mentioned there. A lot of times I hear a whole lot in the church about salvation.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't seem, I don't hear as many sermons on the radio about wisdom and knowledge.
Uh-huh.
So I just wonder if maybe we can tend to overlook that.
Yeah, those certainly are elements that are a part of a truly blessed, redeemed world that God would like to bless us with. And yes, thanks for illuminating those. Well, I got illuminated up here, so I better sit down. Thank you all.
Say